Would you give your mum, dad, aunt or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no!
Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got six comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos and browser history.
Where's your search history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this?
What is... I don't want this one.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising
people. Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This is a Dave original podcast.
This podcast contains bad language, but come on, we're all adults here. What's your problem? Jordan Brooks, look at what you've done. I'm Jordan Brooks, a comedian and professional trauma merchant. You might know me from that guy you saw at that gig who you hated, but your friend, for some reason, absolutely loved. This week, my guest is Desiree Birch. She's all over the telly, appearing on the likes of Taskmaster, Frankie Boyle's New World Order, and 8 out of 10 Cats. We cover her horror film-fueled upbringing.
If I let anything hang over the edge of the bed, it would be devoured by morning.
What she's learned about life and love.
I don't think that we are capable of taking away the magic from love.
And her now infamous self-help book.
I created the book she had to wipe her ass with.
I'm joined by Desiree Birch. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, actually. Not for
good.
Any particular reason. One must assume that you were born.
I made it through the wilderness. Somehow I made it through. Ooh, ooh. Yeah.
So you made it through the wilderness of the womb and you popped out. Where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles, California. And apparently I came out and went right to sleep, which I think speaks well of me. Like I was just like, I'm going to need a nap if I'm going to deal with all of this.
I've had 9 months of sleeping. Do you know what? I could do
a
little bit.
You know
of
what?
Just
a quick catnap. Also, it was 11:30 at night. I was not even 1 year old. So, okay, way past my bedtime.
You had a functioning body clock, yeah. What was your first thought? Do you remember having a thought as a baby? Did you ever think, oh, great, I'm well up for this?
I have never thought that about anything, Jordan, in my life. Thank you so much for thinking that I came out that positive about things. I mean, one of my earliest memories is being on the floor. I mean, it makes sense for a baby, but like I would have been like 3 or 4 or something. And my younger brother and I used to sleep with my mom and she used to sleep on the floor because that was more comfortable to her than beds. So we would just sleep on the floor. So it's like of being sideways next to this blanket that she still has on the floor. You know what I mean? There's something about being on the floor where you're just like, so far, this is as low as I can go, and there is a comfort about that. That's dark for
So even as a baby, you were luxuriating in the void.
Yes, yes. I think that a good chunk of my life has been reckoning with the fact that I'm in it.
So wait, you were asleep on the floor and there was a perfectly usable bed?
Yes. Yes.
What, and your mom, yes. And your mom went, no, she's got to learn.
Knowing my mom a little bit, like, I don't know if she would consciously utter that to herself, but I think underneath she'd be like, this is real. That bed, that's a bed of lies. I mean, I don't know. I think it was a good bed. I just know she liked firm mattresses. Maybe it was too soft. I don't know. It was a middle Goldilocks bed. But like, I also just, I don't know. I think she just like trusted the floor. Sounds so strange. I get it. Beds are shady. Floor, don't lie. You may not like floor, but floor will tell you what like it is every time.
That's so true. Ghosts can't hide under floor.
No,
monsters
can't hide
under floor.
Under
floor. My God, can they congregate under a bed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything's under there. How are you with horror movies? Are you okay with them?
I really like them. They're the only films that me and my girlfriend can watch for some reason. So we can't watch anything else. So it's always pure horror. So I've watched a lot of... I really like the ones where it's not just spooky, but it's also a metaphor for grief or mental illness.
Yes. I mean, I think the horror genre contains a lot of like beauty and the mysteries of the universe, but you just like have to get through all the slashing and weird sea monsters. And I'm very reactive. Like, I can't watch action films because people get shot in them and then I go like, ugh, in the theater, and people turn around like, really, lady? So I respect horror.
Why is that? What is it? Do you just feel an insane empathy with the characters?
Yes, I do. I'm a very easy audience member. Suspension of disbelief right away. I'm in it. Like, you know, what's going on? We're all the same. I believe in you. You're my guy. Oh no, you just got slashed up. I should have bet on a better horse. Like, as with everyone, I think, who grew up in the 80s, who had that fear of letting anything hang over the bed because of the monsters, but because of this film called The Gate that came out in like the 80s, I just firmly believed that if I let anything hang over the edge of the bed, it would be devoured by morning. And I believed this for an absurdly long time, like into double digits, I think. Even though I knew it wasn't true.
Oh, 100%.
So I remember believing in everything for years.
Just so I can get a picture in my head. Your mom was making you sleep on the floor and watch these horrific horror films about monsters that could devour your toes in the night.
So I was like a latchkey kid of the 80s. Basically, like, they gave me a key on a shoestring around my neck and they were like, fend for yourself. And both of my parents were at work all the time, which means I was babysat by a television set. So, you know, when my mom got home from work, we'd have to change the channel from watching things like Married with Children because she thought that was like a, you know, horrible influence of a show and blah, 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 blah. Like, and we'd have to change it to something that was acceptable. But it, like, during the hours she wasn't around, oh, it was like all bets were off. And there was a portion of my young life in which she worked graveyard shift. There was like all this extra time when she was at work that we were just like, ah! And watching anything. Also, my dad, terrible parenting skills, like just let us watch whatever sitting next to him. Like, I distinctly remember watching the original Predator film at like 8 or 9. My first cuss word came out during that time because I saw a man get eviscerated and I went, holy shit!
I think that's on your dad. You say you got a brother?
Yes, I've got a younger brother and then I have an older brother and sister. So,
right,
there's like a big gap between us. So they were kind of like in high school and like early college. They kind of babysat us, but also they were teenagers, which means they like pieced. Do you know what I mean? They were like, you guys are fine. Okay, great. Bye. You know?
So, yeah, you want to watch Hellraiser? Fine.
Yeah, great. I mean, as long as we're watching Hellraiser, we're not out in the middle of the street getting killed by cars, right? So, so fine.
It's the only thing. I mean, that's the only reason why we make films, I think, is to stop people getting hit by cars. Keep people in one place and busy for a couple of hours. Did you find that watching a lot of films and TV and stuff and having this like free access to all this stuff, how did it shape your developing mind?
Oh my God, it entirely shaped my developing mind. Like, I definitely think I'm a comedian and a performer because that's what I watched, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't like the early 19th century and people being like, oh, I really want to get on Instagram, you know? What is this TikTok thing? Like, people... It's like when people go, oh, we didn't used to have iPhones and we used to just play games in the street. And I'm like, yeah, but if you had an iPhone, you would absolutely have been staying inside playing Flappy Bird.
Yes, you would be bored to tears by playing in the street with people that you barely liked anyway and were just associated with because they lived around the corner. You know, like all the people that we would play with in the street are like people I haven't spoken to in at least 30 years. Do you know what I mean? Like, we have nothing to say to each other.
So you had older brothers and sisters. And was that weird sort of growing up with, I guess, like siblings who were already kind of way ahead of you in life?
It was great to have older siblings because, like, they were close and you could kind of be like, oh, that one's messing it up. Even though I'm 8, I can tell, you know, or like my brother had like all these hot friends that like I started having my like first feelings about when I was probably like, you know, 11, 12.
So were you a funny kid? Were you a funny growing up?
Yeah. Yeah, but I was a funny kid because I was a fat kid. And if you want to survive as a fat kid, you better be funny. Do you know what I mean? Because otherwise, you're just going to get dumped on constantly. Like, you just I remember being in kindergarten and having the second grader, because we were in this little fence, like we were in this little pen, the kindergartners, and then the other, like, you know, like first through fifth grade was around us. And you know, I would be in there and I was the fattest kid in kindergarten. I was the fattest kid in all of my years, just like, you know, so we all know that.
Is that something when you're growing up that you just know? Do you look around the room and go, oh, no, it's still me?
No, you know that because you are told by your family first. If you're a woman, your mother goes, you're fat. It's a problem. We got to fix it. It's still one of the like last bastions of just pure hatred in terms of if somebody wants to knock you down, it's the first and last thing they need to say. And they're just like, you know, because they're essentially being like, you're worthless. Shut up. So I do remember specifically this one day, like it was very mechanical, like the little puzzle pieces fit into place. Where I was doing some weird, making faces, doing weird stuff by the fence because the kids had like come out of for their recess and we were still out for our recess and I wasn't playing with anyone. And like all these weird Kool-Aid ring around their mouth kids were like, rah, 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 rah. And I went over there and I was like making fun of them and like making weird faces. And this like weird kid with like a rat tail was like, she's funny. And I just remembered, I was like, oh my God, they're pointing and laughing, not at me, but because of me. And it was just like, boom, got it, done. Do not need to be told twice. This will always work forever and ever. Amen. So it was just always part of what I did to ingratiate myself to anyone in any room I walked into, because it meant that the topic of conversation was me being funny or interesting or charming and not me being fat and somehow a problem.
I had a similar experience where I had bad acne and I started trying to be the funny guy.
Yeah.
And I made one joke about another kid, but no one laughed and the kid immediately punched me in the face. What was it like growing up in LA?
Growing up in the LA area, everything is about Hollywood. Everybody you meet, like, you know, has a script or is writing something or is an actor or, you know, like works behind the scenes or is trying to. And so if that is the sort of organizing value system around things, then it's kind of like you're either in it and you're achieving or you're a failure and you're doing anything else, you know?
Wow, that's a strange environment to grow up in, isn't it? Because I imagine LA is like being a sort of industry event where everyone's putting on a front, everyone's trying to present their best possible selves, they're trying to talk up their accomplishments. There's a front to a lot of it.
Yeah.
What does that do to your brain when you're growing up in that world?
It makes you desperate to get the fuck out of it. Like, you know, you've been to those parties and you're like, what limb do I have to chew off to get out of here? It's weird. Because I'm like, it was definitely very sort of damaging to my sense of self-worth and esteem. But then again, like, that just prepared me for now where everybody's trying to look like Instagram. So like, it's not any different. It's just weird that it's everywhere else too. Because when I was growing up, very early on, I realized, I'm like, I'm going to have to get out of here. In my adult life, I've continued to move like further and further east because as the weather gets worse, the people get more humane, you know? So like I went to school on the East Coast, then I went to New York, and then I like people here. I love British people because you're like, the weather's shit and we're desperate. Like, I can relate to that feeling of like, ah, it sucks. It really just was like, it just felt empty. So I spent most of my young life being a total escapist and waiting until I could finally go somewhere else and like live.
Let's talk about first loves, relationships. What do you remember the first time you fell in love?
I mean, fell in love. You know, the problem with falling in love is that it gets redefined by every new, you know, like I don't know that I fell in love in high school. I just had like massive crushes. I think that the first time that I thought I had fallen in love was like well into my adult life, like 30, you know? So like the people that I liked before were just sort of, so like the first guy I remember in high school that I liked was this dude called Aaron, and he was on mock trial with me. Good old mock trial. Although I was
What's mock trial?
Do you guys have that here? I mean, it's like a forensics type of thing, but it's like pretend lawyers, you know what I mean? But it's like debate, but it's like in a courtroom. So like you're arguing for or against a thing, but like they call it mock trial rather than
school?
You know. Yes. Yeah, so this is like high school.
So you put another child on trial and decide whether or not to convict them. And then do they have to be in mock prison for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, no, it would be more like issues or ideas, you know, and a for and against kind of side, you know, it was for like
the nerds. Dilemma.
Yes, exactly. Right. And he was like one of the, I was sort of like a substitute, like, you know, coming, but he was like.
Substitute lawyer.
I was a paralegal who was very flustered with like an attaché full of papers that meant nothing to her. But he was like
it's great
lawyer.
That you fleshed out your character.
I would imagine if I worked as a paralegal, that would be my recurring nightmare. Like, you know, when you're an actor or a comedian, there's always a nightmare that you have that's very bespoke to your career. And if I were a paralegal, it would just be me having to run into court and they'd be like, Desiree, go. And I just have
just be you running through an endless flurry of papers.
But he was like one of the lead lawyers. He was like a year above me. And he was just like, a tall, brown-haired ectomorph. Like, a guy, like, my type, the type of guy I was into.
I don't think I've ever seen someone casually describe someone as an ectomorph.
But that's exactly my type. Like
that's
the kind of guy.
Term you used to describe, like, that's, you just went, oh, there's a man and he's an ectomorph.
If you know what it means, then you know exactly what he looks like. He's the kind of guy who probably got a collapsed lung in high school because he grew too long, too fast. Like, those are the guys.
So what did you say to him? Did you just say, hey.
I can't remember. I didn't do like
a
fucking
dance. Do you want to take this trial to the bedroom?
Yeah, want to take this trial to the streets? I don't know. No, I wish that I could remember what I said. Like, these days, you know, it's all High School Musical and everybody's doing like a 30-person dance or whatever to ask somebody out to prom. I just was like, do you want to go to Warner Formal? And he was like, no.
But did you feel heartbroken? Did you feel sad?
I did feel sad. I did feel sad. It sucked. Like, it was one of those, like, okay, like, thanks for being so cool about it. Like, super professional. Like, you know, you're a local realtor.
He was playing the lawyer role. And he was like, no, I mustn't. I'm a married man with three children. Of course I can't date you.
Very professional. It's like I passed a note across to him with my final offer and he rejected it. And we shook hands and parted the best of friends. Yeah, I mean, I do remember being like cut up about it, but it's really interesting when you have like a clean break, the getting over it is so much easier. Like twice my life later, probably. When I thought I was really in love with this guy, you know, we had spent like a year like not doing anything. Like, I think we hooked up once during that time, but mostly he was just like holding my hands and calling me up late at night and then like not being my boyfriend. And like women and gay men all understand what this relationship is because it's like the non-relationship where you're like, I'm your nothing, but like it feels like I'm everything to you, except for like you're not doing shit about it.
There's all those sort of unanswered questions.
Yes,
this constant
that they
open question.
Purposefully leave unanswered because they're getting all this milk and they're just friends with the cow. But they always kind of keep it on this uneven footing of like being confused because that's usually involves some element of narcissism where it's just like, I just adore being adored. I mean, it was basically like, I thought that I was going to feel some kind of way about you eventually, but I just haven't. And I don't think I ever will. Like, I just am not as into you as you're into me.
Wow.
And I was like, okay. And of course that hurts and you're like, ow. But then right after ow, you're like, ew. Like, I just remember like the next day just being like, ew, gross. Like, so like, you're not even into me and you did all this dumb stuff with me for like the better part of 13 months. And like, also like, you're dumb. Like, just like, ew. With everything with Aaron in high school, like he let me down in like the best, most like clear, effective, very using his forensic skills, excellent lawyer, no uncertain terms, but also like not unkind because that might create some kind of reprisals or a lawsuit later. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's very professional. You know,
lawyers
about
it. Are notoriously litigious.
So. Yes. If I learned nothing else or got nothing else, I definitely learned like there's a right way to do a thing. And then after that, it was just like every other version of the wrong way for like a clean decade or more.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds, but I had like a good example. Right.
So you said you fell in love when you were 30, or you feel like that was the first time when you got it. You felt you understood.
Yeah. No, not even then. I think I was like, I was a notoriously late bloomer. And I also was the kind of person, because anybody who struggles with like any kind of issues around self-worth or whatever, or any kind of fucked up family issues, you're constantly transferring those relationship dynamics onto people. So you're constantly, like, if you've been sort of abandoned or rejected or whatever by your family, you're looking for people who are going to reject you so you can try to win them over, because that's all the excitement. So all of those guys that I was in love with were just like people who were like, you know, dangling a carrot somewhere off in the distance. And I was like, oh, I'm going to keep chasing it. And I think that, you know, the first time that I felt love in a requited way was with Ant, the guy I moved here to be with. So, you know, that was like 35, you know, that was like, you know, I love you, you love me back.
Love should really be taught in schools, like sex education.
Yeah.
Like how to put a condom over your heart to protect against wankers.
I believe that love is a huge enough thing that teaching people the basics of it. Like, I don't think that we are capable of taking away the magic from love, because it is so much more than the sum of its parts, that teaching people what the parts of love are, or the ingredients, or the whatever, you know, it's like everybody has a love that's slightly different. It's the same with sex education. Like, I think, you know, it's a thing that's in school now, but it wasn't before, because they just assumed your parents would tell you. And then we found out that nobody's parents were saying anything, but like, wear a condom, bye, you know? Like, so they had to teach it in school. You know, a lot of times if you don't have that at home, you know, displayed for you, like, you know, and even if it is displayed for you, you know, like all you're doing is mimicking that.
It's learning to love yourself.
Yes. And of course, you know, RuPaul has never lied, because you can't fob the job off on anyone else of loving yourself. And that's what a lot of us really want to do. I'm like, why should I waste my perfectly valuable time loving myself when some other idiot could do that for me? And that idiot is you. Like, when the good people started coming into my life was when I had developed a slightly improved relationship with myself. I mean, the good news is, because, like, when you hear that, you're like, oh, fuck, why do I have to do everything? You know, it's like, you know, you can't be loved. You can't love anyone else until you love yourself. And you're like, I've got a stack of self-help books. Like, I'm doing so much work. And I would say, like, it doesn't take much, like, one thing can really like click a dial over into you treating yourself differently. And that means that you then treat other people differently, which means that you see different things in other people, and you also attract different kinds of people. And suddenly it's all different. Like, I feel like I was stuck for so long in these. Anyway, I mean, this isn't a show about my love and dating life, but like, there's so many faces.
No, but it's so interesting.
Thank you. I appreciate, but it's, I mean, it's taken so long to get to that place to like see from a distance, where it's like I was like giving so much away, you know? And like, everybody knows if you see somebody giving something away, you're like, well, that must be worthless. And like, I, you know, I'm with someone now who I am completely in love with. And before I met him, I was like, oh, I'm going to be alone forever. Mm. And I just started operating based on that reality. And, I, you know, and which is great because then people want to come into your reality and you're like, no, thank you. Like, I'm sorted. Like, you know, which is a much better energy to be putting out if you actually want to bag somebody.
Sounds like you're the one playing games here.
Yeah. I need to write a reverse of like The Game or whatever for women. Yeah. It's like, if you want to meet a guy in a bar, sit there and read a book, because if you are reading a book or you're writing in a journal, you will be interrupted by every man in that bar trying to find out everything about you. And you're like, I just came here to drink alone and read alone. But now you've got 5 phone numbers. Yeah. It will work. I promise.
That sounds great. These things sound like cliches, don't they? Or you should meditate more. You should learn to live yourself before you can love, you know, love another person. Unfortunately, and really annoyingly, they're all true.
Yes, they
are. They're all absolutely correct. There's a reason why they have persisted throughout time.
It's really about timing. You just get to the time in your life where you've exhausted pretty much all the other options. And you're like, let's just try this shit then. Like, there was this pizza place in New York. I can't remember where it was in Queens, but it was like on their box. Let's just say it was called Ray's. I can't remember what it was called, but it was like, you've tried the rest. Now give Ray's a chance. Like, now try Ray's for a change. It was something like that. Like, they were like, instead of being like, try the best, they were just like, just try ours now.
Just give this one a go, please. Go on.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what it is. It's like you've tried everything else and you just give the other one a go and then you just keep going with it. Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
So Desiree, in 2030, you finally tied the knot with your long-term partner. Why did it take so long?
Yeah, well, you know, we were very hell-bent on buying property in London. So after 3 or 4 years of just trying and failing, I think we both kind of decided, like, are you sure? And then we spent another couple of years just like rampantly dating, bedding any other person that we could find until we were like, well, you tried the rest. Let's give this one a try again.
So the pair of you went off and slept with as many people as possible to be absolutely certain that it was the right choice.
Yeah.
Was that not exhausting? Did that not end up causing a lot of injuries, both emotional and physical?
There were more physical injuries because, like, part of the reason that we knew we were really meant to be together is because we kept calling each other to, like, compare notes, you know? And then it was the kind of thing where it was like he was in the lead. So I was like, oh, okay, I got to go out and make some real bad mistakes just to catch up. And then I shared those and he was like, oh, you did that? Well, then I should do that too, you know? So it was just this race to the bottom, really. Mm. And when we finally hit rock bottom, there we both were.
That's where you had the wedding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's like, you want to come to the wedding, come down here, because really Who wants to go to a wedding?
So it was quite a small affair, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You had two witnesses and that was it.
Yeah, but like the DJ was banging. So like people around outside were like, what is happening in this hole? Like there's a well and the best sounds are coming out of it. You know, like if you're going to put money into an affair, like do it right. I did want a party. Mm. So like we had our witnesses, you know, we each had a parent remaining, you know, somebody to give somebody mm-hmm. to someone else and someone to like, you know, talk absolute rubbish about the other person so that everybody was like, you know, up to speed. And yeah, but the music was on fire.
So by the time it got to the reception, the witnesses and the family, they couldn't be asked. They'd already gone home. So it was just you and your husband dancing alone.
Yeah. Well, and also just like random stray people on MDMA, like coming down into the well, being like, what's happening in here?
Requesting Kasabian. And, yeah.
Yeah. You know, right? So then there was a whole second shift to the wedding where they were just like stray 20-year-olds, like, you know, falling in. Like we made some lifelong friends that night. It was really better than a wedding because you already know those people.
Yeah.
And you already know what they're capable of. And if it was anything good, you probably wouldn't be having the boring wedding that you normally would have if you don't have it in a hole with a great DJ.
It sounds like such a lovely day. I mean, I've seen photos of it, but unfortunately it was in pitch black. So
yeah, really hard to make out. Sometimes
very hard
you get
to make out
shape.
What the hell's going on. Yeah, you just see a lot of people gurning.
Yes, every so often a glow stick would help, you know what I mean? There's so much gurning.
Well, it sounds like a lovely day. And so of course you stayed living in London, that's right?
To move any further east is Russia.
Mm.
You know, like there's got to be a limit.
As the seawater levels rise and the cliffs crumble, the coast crumbles, then you sort of end up becoming more east whether you're moving or not.
That's absolutely true. That is absolutely true.
So even though you stayed in London, by the time you were sort of 60, you both were living right on the coast, teetering actually.
No one would have ever actually thought that buying a place in like Enfield would be beachfront property. But, you know, there you go. At some point, global weirding, you know,
suddenly
it's like if there were anyone left to sell this place to, we'd be rich. But, you know, all those people fell into the sea. You know, we started swimming later in our 40s just because we could see the way the tide was turning, you know, so to speak.
Your comedy career had continued. You'd done a lot of you'd done a lot of touring. You'd also been, I know you'd been previously, you'd been doing a voiceover for a dating show. Is that right?
Yes.
As a result of that, you ended up getting your own show, didn't you, that you were hosting, where it was you matchmaking ectomorphs.
Yes, exactly. Because they're particularly bad about matching themselves. I find that every man 6'4" taller dates somebody who's 5'2" or smaller. Mm-hmm. And it just became like not an effective use of space.
There'd been a lot of age gap discourse.
Yes, of course.
And it had moved into height gap discourse.
Yes, discourse. Yeah.
And so people would say anyone 3 inches higher or lower than their partner, there was something problematic about that.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, you know, there also part of that was a bit of a pivot because by the time that we got to really homing in on ectomorphs, there was already a tall guy, small old lady show. What was the name of that show? It was like my super tall, small life. It was something like that. But I mean, that was running for seasons and we had kind of already peaked. I have to be real. We were just like throwing anything at the wall at that point to see what would work to try to get us more seasons because, you know, I needed to build a retaining wall around the house.
You'd continue doing that. You got more into TV. But of course, you'd sort of spoken very beautifully about love and relationships. And you felt like around about 60, 65, you felt like it was time to publish that wisdom in the form of a self-help book.
Yes, yes.
How did you feel when it was almost universally critically panned?
Here's the thing. Books went out of style by like 2035, right? So like even trying to create anything in the medium was like a cry for help of the sort of last remaining Gen Xers and millennials that were trying to cleave to some semblance of, you know, dignity. You know, I mean, there are some really, really hot Twitter threads. And my publicist really said, like, you know, I think this is maybe like a year long thread that you just kind of keep posting to rather than a book. Mm. But I was really beholden of like, no, I really think that young people are thirsty for something that like feels real, like, you know, like paper bound and whatnot. And it turns out they really weren't.
People sort of said that the generations of kids had forgotten how to read and they didn't know how to concentrate on something for any length of time, and that it was a shame that the world had taken this particular shape. But like, I think fair play though. Margaret Atwood did do some cracking TikToks.
Yeah, I mean, my goodness. Just some of the moves that like nobody knew that that woman had. Yeah, and
it's amazing that The Handmaid's Tale could be reduced to a 15-second performance piece.
Yeah, and like, I have to admit that, yes, the book was universally panned, probably because I chose to write it in full words and full sentences.
Big mistake.
Emoji, Bitmoji, sticker, like 90% of it, that's how most things are structured these days.
By that point, EastEnders was just a 10-second barrage of visuals that would tell a story. You know, it was almost like we were sort of just kind of injecting ourselves with entertainment. You know, it's just this sudden blast and we'd understand it. And it's also a great way to get into things like Breaking Bad. You know, if you just, you feel excluded from conversation and you just go, I'll be right back.
Yeah.
And then you pop down to the clinic.
Yeah.
And they inject you with five seasons of Emmy award winning drama.
I was so happy when I finally got injected with The Sopranos and The Wire so I could go talk to people from 40 years prior to be like, that was really good when Tony whacked that guy. And they were like, why are you still talking about this? And I'm like, I'll put it in the book. Don't worry about it. Just buy the book. Please buy the book.
It must have been a bit of a blow because obviously, you know, you felt like you'd spent years accumulating this wisdom and getting this sense of the world. And you must have been so eager and so excited to put it out there. And then for the world to turn around and go, actually, this is some of the biggest bullshit we've ever heard in our lives.
Honestly, one of the biggest sort of knives in the heart was when... Do you remember when the hologram of Joan Didion did the TikTok video of her wiping her ass with the pages of my book?
I'll never forget it.
Why she posthumously got credit for that and I got no credit considering I created the book she had to wipe her ass with. I don't know. I'm just saying, I know you're not allowed to say you were robbed, you know, but I feel like this always happens with content creators of color. You know, other people get the credit.
It is a problem. You know, when books come out now, people will go, I'll wait for the TikTok. Cheers. What did it do to you as a person who, I guess, you know, felt like they understood the world? You spoke earlier beautifully about relationship patterns and learning how to love. Did that not call into question all of those things? Did you not suddenly go, actually, I might have got this wrong. I should have stayed with my first boyfriend at school.
Yeah. Good old Aaron who rejected me. I definitely should have stayed by his side, honestly, because I mean, he was, you know, a lawyer for all of those years. Like, I would have been far more wealthy than I ever was making books that nobody reads. I was finally alone again. You know, I had to mourn the loss of my love. But, you know, he always had hypertension and issues, probably because he was arguing with me, which I realize in retrospect, I only made things worse. And me carrying on about, you know, why didn't I get credit for the butt wipe dance? Like, probably didn't help his underlying health conditions. But it turns out loving yourself too much makes people hate your guts. And, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm really drawn to your confidence. It's like, don't you know what you wrote was terrible and misleading for people who can still read? And those 11 people have their lives ruined now.
They all ferociously read it like it was the new Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And by the end of that day, their lives were completely devastated. You know, people went from being in healthy marriages with houses to being homeless and confused. It was a catastrophic shift in gear for people.
For a lot of people, you know. And so, you know, everybody knew someone or knew someone who knew someone who had remembered how to read so that they could read the book. I always wanted to leave a legacy. I just didn't think that it was going to be leaving the world in tatters. You know, it's kind of like when there are those cataclysmic events, like I think that there might be like something in a sediment, like archaeologists will find the layer when Desiree Birch's Help Yourself came out and the world just shat the bed.
And of course, they buried all the books with chains and a padlock around it to ensure that no one ever opened and read it. Despite the critical pushback, and the damage that you caused and the lawsuits that ensued from people whose lives you had absolutely ruined. Yeah, you went ahead and released a sequel.
Yeah. Well, I actually wrote a couple of different sequels. You know, that was the one that I released that I thought was going to be to kind of close the circle, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was either a double down or an undoing of the damage you'd done.
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. It was kind of like, but I don't think that you understood me the first time. And I did take on board the notes about using more emojis and stickers and whatnot, you know, more
gifts. It's a very long book title, but it did work.
Oh, yeah. It's like from the lady who wrote the book that you wiped your ass with, here are some great pieces of knowledge that were pulled out of my ass to be put back on the page. Try wiping your ass with this. Ha, 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 ha. And then winking, kiss, blowing heart face.
It was beautiful. And it did end up doing way more harm than good, didn't it?
I mean, I sold the book for like £1.70, you know, like that's just like, you know, coughing money. That's just like, oh, I dropped this. I'm not bending over to pick it up. That's like nothing. And I did that because I knew that most of the people who were going to read it were the homeless people whose lives that I destroyed, you know, and took away everything that belonged to them. And I just wanted to make sure that they had access to it, you know, and not everybody has like a Kindle chip in their heads. So I wanted to make sure, you know, they could read it and get some goodness from it. And it turns out that wasn't the case.
Well, I think you did do some good. You know, I think you did right some of your wrongs, and there were a lot of people who did who agreed. And
thank
in fact, you did end up having a statue made in your honor. But in order to appease those who opposed it, the statue was just very small.
Yes, very, very.
So you
tiny.
Got a statue, but it was a tiny one.
The good thing about a tiny statue is that when the protesters come to knock it over, they can just put it right back up.
Yeah.
Like it's just like basically on a bench. Like it's not even that big a deal. It's like you can knock it over and protest me anytime you want to. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've made it out of memory foam. It'll bounce back, you know. And, you know, I think it will probably set a precedent for statues of, you know, other people who are probably out there doing terrible things. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know why they didn't build all the Donald Trump statues out of that seem to permeate the universe and space now.
And also, like, anyone who's trying to tear that statue down just looks so silly trying to roll it into the river.
Yeah. Yeah. And with their friends. It's like you needed a group of people to do this. Really? And signs? You couldn't have just kicked it.
As you'd come towards the end of your life, you were divorced by this point. So let's talk about your death, because you'd been planning your funeral since you were a child.
Yeah.
You had your little scrapbook, didn't you, of pictures of coffins and
pictures of coffins, pictures of burial spots, the menu plan for the wake. I had certain people who were meant to read poems and, you know, other people to stoke the stories and when the flights of Jägermeister would come in, because then you kind of need to change it over into a nighttime thing. But, you know, it had kind of fallen apart to start when the DJ got buried alive, because he was a crucial element.
Well, you'd built it all around him, really, hadn't you?
Yeah, a bit. I mean, you kind of need the undergirding of a score for something that is meant to be that epic, because at the end, it was really going to launch into the, like, waiters coming around with the trays of blotter acid for everyone just to really finally take off into the dreamscape that I had woven for them. And then it would have been a three-night party, ultimately ending with, you know, my body. Well, look, I left it up to people. I said, look, I do want the mushroom suit because I think it would be useful to make my body useful. But, you know, I know how much people hate me and the legacy I've left. So if you want to put it onto like a set of skateboards taped together and just float it out to sea on fire.
I want to talk about the nature of your death, because it's a strange one, isn't it? You were growing up watching a lot of horror films. So you've seen a lot of people die in fictional settings. And with the help of Aaron, the cosplaying lawyer, you were able to create a scenario where you were horrifically murdered.
Yes.
So you were actually sort of playing the role of victim, but it was a permanent role.
Yes. So the reason he wouldn't return any of my calls is because the job didn't quite get finished. And I was trying to call him to say I didn't get fully murdered. The guy with the chainsaw stopped because he got to my hip replacement and couldn't get through it because he hadn't brought the right kit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by the time I actually died, I'd been working at a haunted house for a week and a half. Like, you know, I just assumed that this was going to be the rest of my life and I wasn't going to die this way. And then to like actually die in the haunted house, you know, like, which is like, they all thought I was on drugs. And I was like, no, I was murdered 3 months ago. I just wasn't fully murdered. And so I thought I'd monetize this because, you know, I mean, like, it's the day and age that we live in, right? If I'd only figured out the chainsaw dance for like a TikTok, I might have been able to really make something out of that moment. But alas, no one would have me except for the haunted house. And I just eventually kind of slumped over in a corner when I was supposed to be saying boo and arr. And
it's a sad way to go, but go you did.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Your funeral, obviously, we've talked a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Who was at your funeral?
Well, you know, I mean, Aaron obviously couldn't come, you know, because of him being implicated in my murder. You know, my partner had passed, and, you know, most of my friends turned their backs on me, you know, after the first book, and those who did definitely did after the second. My younger brother came, God bless him. He definitely came through in the end with his wife and family. And, you know, I mean, he wisely instructed them not to look inside of the casket because there's going to be a woman in a weird fungus suit with half of a chainsaw on her and it doesn't even make sense. And aside from that, there were definitely some protesters, but I still appreciate that they came. My best friend Dave came because he was always going to, you know, like you got to have a best friend and they got to love you even when you've asked to be murdered and you've ruined a lot of people's lives, you know, because like he was all set up. He didn't read my book because, I mean, when do your friends ever read your books, come to your shows or do it? Right. Exactly. They're always like, I'll get the next one. And thankfully, I didn't ruin his life. So he did come. I'm a firm believer in that the only one who doesn't know you is you, you know? You're never going to fully know you. You're on the journey, but everybody else has a different glimpse, a different page in the book of who you are. They all have, but they don't know what that is because most of them don't know what books are anymore. And see, I was trying to... Anyway, nobody gets me.
Desiree Birch, look at what you've done.
That was Desiree Birch, whose toxically misguided ideas of love and relationships inspired the world to never have sex again, resulting in the end of the human race.
Have you ever wondered what it'd be like to nose around a comedian's house, take their stuff and see how much money you can make by selling it?
No, that's a pretty niche thing, to be honest. Bit creepy, really.
But that's the premise of Dave's brand new comedy podcast, Hard Sell, with me, Josh Jones.
And me, Darren Harrier. We're going to travel the country, visiting the homes of different comedians, chatting about their spending habits before grabbing one of their favourite possessions and giving ourselves 1 week to try and sell it for charity. In a competition to see who can raise the most money.
It's a right laugh as we get to meet amazing funny people like Kima Bob, Joel Domic, Ria Lina, Ivo Graham, Josh Pugh and lots more.
But also sort of like an incredibly stressful cheese dream where we're trying to shift what are essentially stolen goods against the clock. It's bonkers.
Hard Sell with Josh Jones
and Darren Harrier.
Available now wherever you get your podcasts.